Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from Igor Volsky, and we're going to be talking about the state of health reform on a federal level. Right now, I would like to welcome Jim Ledyard. He is the head of school for the New Mexico School for the Arts, and Adelma Nasco is the director of admissions there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So this is a brand new charter school that hasn't opened yet, and it's a school for the arts. Tell us, Jim, about the genesis of this school.
The school has been in the making for almost 5 years now. It started as an idea, I think primarily with Catherine Oppenheimer, who is the founder of the National Dance Institute here in New Mexico. And her feeling and feedback from parents and friends that the school needed a school for the arts really was a gap in the secondary education of the state of New Mexico. And so from that genesis, eventually the idea of creating a high school for the arts here in Santa Fe came, and eventually the state legislature approved the concept, and now we're on the verge of opening. We'll open in August.
And there was basically state support for this on the legislative level, supported by Governor Richardson.
Indeed, and many members of the state legislature, a number of whom co-signed, co-authored the bill that was eventually resulted in the creation of the school. And that group really represents all aspects of the state, all areas of the state.
So it's a high school, 9 through 12th grade.
Grades 9 through 12.
And so what will students have the opportunity to study there?
We're going to offer four departments. We'll have a music department, a theater department, a visual arts department, and a dance department. And so students really will be participating in what we call a dual curriculum. So there'll be a normal high school curriculum for them to achieve their high school diploma. And there'll be a parallel additional curriculum in the area that they major in, whether it be dance or theater, what have you.
And so is this school based on any model of an existing school somewhere?
There are quite a number of schools like this around the country, some sponsored by their states and others sponsored by cities, which are either charter schools, as ours is going to be, or they're magnet schools in certain large districts. So we're modeling ourselves after the most successful of those, and we have a residential, since it's a statewide school, we have a residential department as well, so students can come from anywhere in New Mexico to attend the school.
I was just going to add that residential program is a 5-day residential program, so that students from around the state of New Mexico can be living here during the week and then go back home to their community from which they came on the weekends.
Where's the school going to be?
School's going to be located, the classroom buildings will be located in the schoolhouse that has been the St. Francis Cathedral School as part of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe for the past 60 years. It's a wonderful historic building designed in 1947 and in use since 1948 until just 3 years ago when the Archdiocese reorganized its elementary school education. And we're very excited about it. It's a great building. It's a tremendous amount of space, over 36,000 square feet.
Wow.
Terrific location right at Alameda and Paseo de Peralta. And so it's central. It's right in the middle of the action in Santa Fe.
Is it near the actual cathedral?
Yes, it's on the same property.
Okay. So students will be able to come from all over the state, and there will be dormitories somewhere.
The dormitories will not be on the same location. As you probably know, that site doesn't have any dormitories on it. But the dorms will be on an existing campus that's used to having students board and will be a comfortable, secure, attractive boarding environment just a couple of miles from the campus.
So you are now accepting applications
Correct.
To the school. Is it going to be a highly competitive, do you think, entrance?
We are currently accepting applications from all over the state. We've had young people inquire from across New Mexico, and we are busy driving all around the state at this point to let young people know about this opportunity and tell them to apply. So any young person who has interest, passion, talent, or aptitude in the arts, we are encouraging to apply to the school.
And are you taking students at all grade levels at the beginning?
In our first year, we'll take students in 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. So any young person from New Mexico who will be entering one of those grades next year would be eligible. And we ask that they first submit an inquiry form, which can be done online at our website, which is nmschoolforthearts.org. And once that inquiry form has been submitted, we can then follow these students and help them with the application process. The full application is due by February 5th, which is really just around the corner. So we're working hard right now to spread the word as quickly as we can to the far corners of this state so young people know about this.
Are you going to be specializing in arts of New Mexico as well as more generalized arts? In other words, Spanish, Hispanic, Chicano, Indian kind of arts?
Well, we're not going to be specializing in that. There won't be a department that students are allowed to major in that particular area, but we will certainly be featuring it. And we have a number of artists who come forward and whom we have approached who are who are very strong in those areas and who are interested in providing some instruction for our students. So we're excited about that.
Have you got your faculty together yet?
No. I'm starting by hiring the 5 or 6 teachers who will be the prime lead teachers in the arts, and then I'll depend on them to give us advice and direction on the next people that we will add to those departments. And we are... What we haven't mentioned yet is that there's really a 2-stage process for the application. It's a first step, which is filing a paper application, getting recommendations and from your art teacher, from your principal, and so forth. And then the second stage, for those students who appear to be strong candidates for the school, is the audition process. And so a large number of the students who apply to the school will be invited to... give an audition, and those auditions will be judged by panels of artists from throughout the state of New Mexico who will be reviewing each of those auditions and then making decisions about which of those students will be eventually admitted to the school. So it's a two-step process.
The whole putting together of a school like this is an interesting process because on the one hand, there has to be leadership on your part. On the other hand, it really has to be a kind of community-wide process of attracting people.
Exactly. And that community, broad community, was in place before I got here. It's been it started with a small nucleus and has grown really to be a regional network. So we have friends and supporters already all over the state, and we're trying to add to those as we go along. So we've had friends in the legislature, friends in the Department of Education, friends who are just art patrons from around the state and so forth, and we're building that steadily.
And that's really paralleled by our location. Because we are in the downtown area, the young people at our school will be able to access the tremendous artistic and cultural resources available in Santa Fe. And we really envision a curriculum that focuses on artistic training not only in the classroom, but beyond the classroom walls as well.
We're talking to the folks from the New Mexico School for the Arts. It's a brand new charter school that is opening this fall. Jim Ledyard is head of the school. Adelma Nasco is director of admissions. New Mexico has, on a national scale, how should we politely say it, below average rankings. I mean, we're not doing that well compared to other states. We're not doing that well in terms of high school dropout rate, in terms of what people know when they graduate. Where does this school fit in? I mean, are you going to try to get the best and the brightest so you don't have to deal with the remedial aspect of it, or is that part of it as well?
Well, the application process expects that the students are prepared for whatever level of schooling they're applying for. So are you eligible to be 11th grader? Are you eligible to be a 9th grader in terms of your previous schooling? But we're primarily looking for young people who are as Adelma said, passionate, talented, have a strong aptitude and a skill set in their particular area where they want to concentrate in. And I expect that our school beyond that will be very strong academically. I think the departments outside of the arts will be highly successful. I expect our students will not only achieve the well beyond the standard expectations in terms of test scores and so forth, but that we're going to have a, you know, I'm going to be unhappy if we don't have 100% high school graduation rate 2 years from now when we graduate our first class and every year thereafter. What we're trying to do is prepare the students through this mastery approach to the particular discipline they enroll in, prepare them to go on either to higher education and to further study in that area, or in some cases to directly into the artistic profession that they're choosing. And we're committed to ensure that the students who do want to go on to higher education in university or conservatory will have that option, will be well prepared, will have that option.
It'll be so interesting to see how it develops, because it's unprecedented in New Mexico, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. The big difference here is that there are other lots of good charter schools in the state. The big difference here is that we're selecting them on the basis of an audition rather than on the basis of lottery, which is the normal either statewide or district organized charter approach.
Do you have a sense of how many students will be residential living in dormitories versus commuting from Santa Fe and environs?
You know, we don't have any way of really gauging these things. We're expecting, and we've arranged for, about 24 dormitory beds for the next year, and that's what we're planning on at this point. But if we have a large large influx of applications who want to be residential students and they're qualified and they get through the auditions, then we'll figure out some way to find comparable housing for them. So it's very hard to forecast these things. I don't know how many applications we're going to have. We already have close to 100 official inquiries and applications in process, and we have several weeks to go before the deadline. So
the deadline is the 5th of February?
Exactly.
That's correct. Yeah. And we are anticipating about 125 students for this first year. Eventually the school can have 300, but we're going to incrementally build up to that number.
So the 125 spread over the three grade levels.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I would imagine that in Santa Fe, where there are many, many artists and professionals in the arts of all kinds, and really not that much work, you would have a great pool of teachers to choose from.
We have a tremendous amount of interest. It's not only from Santa Fe, but from throughout the state of New Mexico, and in fact, all over the country. We have applicants from New York City, from San Francisco, and most spots in between. I put out the call for applications for the four major departments looking for lead teachers or department heads. And I think to date we've received almost 200 submissions for those five or six spots. So it's been terrific. It's been phenomenal. I've really enjoyed the conversations I've had, the interviews I've been able to hold, the telephone calls, and the quality of the pool is just remarkable.
One of the problems that I think we're facing in New Mexico is that because the high school dropout rate is so high, that there's a real pressure to lower your standards. In a school like this, I would imagine that what you're trying to do is raise the standards by orders of magnitude above what exists in, I hate to say it, but, and with some beautiful shining exceptions, a lot of the public schools.
Well, we're going to be different in a couple of critical ways. In the charter school movement in general, and the most successful charter schools are all over the country. There are dozens of them, hundreds of them. They're based on the student's choice. Students and the families choose where they're going to send their youngster to be educated, and that's a key ingredient. In this case, in addition to choosing us, students will have to pass through the audition, and they're going to have to demonstrate that they're very, very excited by and passionate about a particular art form, or maybe several art forms. And so that kind of sets us in a particular frame that it's difficult to duplicate in a public school where the students attend because they're living in a certain area, for example, and they don't have a choice. So a combination of choice and passion and skill is certainly going to have a student body that achieves dramatically above what would be possible in their earlier environments. We're going to be spending more time. The school day is going to be longer. Kids are going to have to be committed, and that commitment translates into school success in whatever areas, and in fact, in all the areas, I expect. So the schools like this around the country, the students are well above the norm in terms of how they test, how many of them graduate, what percentage graduate, how many of them go on to higher education, and so forth. This model is a very successful model.
And within the artistic arm of our school, so much of the assessment takes place through performances and exhibits and actual hands-on doing and making and creating, which for a lot of young people is a very real, honest assessment tool that makes a lot of sense to them. So as Jim said, we've got this dual curriculum. Half of it is academic and the other half is artistic and creative, which gives us an entirely different rubric with which to work and with which to assess and with which to build excellence throughout the school.
And if kids don't end up performing or living up to the standards of the school, I imagine that there will be plenty of other kids willing to take their place at a moment's notice.
Well, we're going to give them more than a moment to be successful. We want we're going to believe in the students that we admit, and we want them all to be successful. We want them all to graduate. We want them all to begin to meet their dreams artistically and as young people and so forth. But we do have the option if somebody really proves that they're not ready for the task of finding room for another student to take that seat.
Do you have to deal with No Child Left Behind?
Sure.
What does that entail?
Well, we're going to be expected to show progress in terms of test scores related to overall achievement on a yearly basis, and those expectations are the same as any other public high school.
The reason I ask is because I've heard teachers quite recently talking about how it's quite limiting to them to have to be continually teaching to the test instead of using their own teaching methods, which are creative and engaging, and you're just teaching to the test. That can be a limitation. How do you transcend that?
I think the students have got to have some experience with the kinds of testing that you're going to be sitting them for, testing them for, but I think that the high level of the kind of motivation that's going to prevail in every classroom of this new school is going to really offset some of that, some of the problems of having to narrow your curriculum and teach specifically to the test. I expect we'll do very well.
Adelma, tell us about some of the kinds of applications that you've already received.
Oh, it is such an exciting moment for us and for the state of New Mexico, and to be in a position where we see the landscape of young people across our state is just really a tremendous position to be in. So we've gotten about 100 inquiries from youth from around the state who are interested in moving forward with the application process. These are very different kids from all over the state with interest in dance, be it ballet or contemporary, visual arts. Many of these young people really like photography and digital media, so we will definitely include that within our visual arts programming. Just very talented, multimedia, interesting, curious people. It really gives me hope. It's excellent to see that our young people are out there with such creativity. And if there is a young person out there listening who has interest in the school, I really encourage you to go to our website, nmschoolforthearts.org, or you can call me personally. Can I give them my number?
Of course, yeah.
920-0965 is my direct number at New Mexico School for the Arts, and I would love to hear from young people or parents of young people who might have an interest in attending our school. I grew up in New Mexico, and when I was in high school, this opportunity didn't exist. This is such an important piece of the continuum of arts learning in our state, and it is a free high school, and for teaching and learning of this caliber to be totally free is just a gift to Mexico and to New Mexico's young people. So I encourage anyone out there listening who might have interest to please apply. And hurry, we don't have a lot of time.
Right. One thing that is always interesting and talked about, for example, when we talk about theater, there are people who do theater, there are actors that are based in New Mexico. There's some brilliant actors, for example, at the College of Santa Fe over the years. The second they graduate, they leave the state like a bolt. Is there going to be any, I mean, thoughts about keeping a continuum with the existing arts infrastructure to kind of keep students here once they graduate?
We're going to have lots of partnerships, both with secondary ed programs, with higher ed programs, and we hope a lot of internship opportunities for our students when they're juniors and seniors so that they can get out and see what the local scene looks like from an artistic point of view. So we hope so. But, you know, before, if there were really terrific art students who were way head and shoulders above others in their age group, they didn't have any place to go at the secondary school level. So now we're providing that. And we think that eventually we'll see an increase in that pool of young artists who stays here in the state.
It'll be interesting to see, too, that the young people who are doing dance and visual art and music or some combination of all the things that you're offering.
It's absolutely true. We're asking young people to apply within a particular discipline, one of the four disciplines in which we'll be teaching, but we have heard from so many kids around New Mexico, well, I want to apply in two, or I want to apply in three, which is revealing to us how interdisciplinary these young people are and talented across the artistic media. So we're doing our best to meet them there and provide mastery for them within a particular discipline while also introducing them to what it is to be learning across the arts and through all of those artistic forms.
Yeah. I had a conversation just recently with a man who's a wonderful artist, and he was just bending my ear about how much he hated NPR because there's no arts reporting. And it's as if the arts do not constitute an important part of society. And I thought, fair enough. You know, maybe in some magazine shows, but in the normal news of what's important. I mean, if Picasso died, well, he's dead, but somebody like, you know, that caliber died, they might report it in a 5-minute segment, but that's it. And I think something that your school shows just symbolically and really to the larger community is that this is integrally important to communities.
Absolutely. And there are those young people who know that they want to go on to really excel within, say, the discipline of dance, to be a ballerina or to take it to that level of expertise. There are also those young people who know that this is a beautiful way in which they develop creative thinking skills and the capacity to take risks in a creative medium. And we are about fostering all of that.
You know, I've been so deeply into this process, helping put this school together and put the application process together and so forth for the last 4 months, that I don't see that world anymore that you see. That's not about the arts, because this is so global for this area, it seems. So the arts are in every corner of New Mexico, we're finding, and so it's really not so much that it's not there. Maybe it's not highly enough regarded by the broad population, but it's certainly there. We're seeing great art being made and being done and being performed all over the place.
A friend of mine is an art teacher back east, and he said, American culture is like a paved-over parking lot. It's paved over with asphalt, and all these creative little plants keep on coming up through the cracks, and they just keep paving it over, and they keep coming up. I thought, well, that's a pretty bleak metaphor for the arts in our country, but I understand what he was talking about.
No, I think I think that understates the amount of growth and activity and creativity that's going on, certainly all over New Mexico, and I think my experience all over the country. So I'm more optimistic about the future of the arts than your friend, maybe.
It does remind me, though, we were just over at the new campus for the school, which, as Jim said, is on the corner of Alameda and Paseo in the old St. Francis Cathedral School, and that was Bishop Lamy's garden at one point before the school building was built. And so for me, there was this beautiful image of all of his plants and the cultivation of growth, and that now our school is about the cultivation of creativity and creative growth. And so it's a real privilege for us to be in that spot that has such a history of, you know, bringing the water and seeding the field and making something beautiful out of it. So if we can take your friend's metaphor of asphalt and shift that a little bit to the springs underneath the Santa Fe dirt next to the river and celebrating the creativity of our youth, then we'd like to do that.
I like that. Nice metaphor.
Jim Ledyard is the head of school for the New Mexico School for the Arts. Adelma Nasco is director of admissions. The school is on the web at nmschoolforthearts.org. Adelma's direct number is 505-920-0965. And if anybody has missed any of this, they can certainly write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org, as always. Anything that you want to add before we go?
Thank you for your work and for broadcasting this. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Exactly. Thanks so much for having us on. And I've admired your program since I've arrived in New Mexico, and I'm glad to be part of it now.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome Igor Volsky. He is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. And he's been on the show a number of times to talk about healthcare reform. And we are talking today. He's in Washington, D.C., having an update. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Igor.
Thanks for having me back on. Happy to be here.
So where are we with healthcare reform now? We started out a couple of months ago talking about the possibilities for a public option. These seem to now officially be dead, killed by a combination of the Senate and the insurance industry itself. Is that right?
I think that's right. We knew from the very beginning that the public option was going to be an uphill climb, especially in the Senate, where you need 60 votes to break a filibuster. And as it turned out, several senators, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, played kingmaker and decided that they wouldn't vote for a bill that includes a public option. And so they took it out single-handedly. Joe Lieberman, of course, Connecticut has a lot of insurers in that state. And so it's certainly not surprising that that a senator from Connecticut, a senator who's taken a lot of insurance money throughout his career, would try to strike the public option from the bill. And if you look at his reasons for opposing a public option, they don't really make sense either. So you're only driven to believe that there's some influence here. But you're right to say that it looks like we won't have a public option in the final bill. We'll have just an exchange of private insurers, which, you know, if designed correctly, could still work. But I think I, along with many progressives, as we saw this past week, are very disappointed.
There's a couple of things about it that are disturbing, I think, from the point of view of people who have been either bankrupted by healthcare costs or have not been able to afford insurance at all. And one of them is that these people like Joe Lieberman don't seem to be representing their districts. They seem to be representing the corporations in their districts, which is not the same thing. Do you have a sense of what the public outcry and the public participation has been on this issue?
Well, it's pretty phenomenal. The public option, which is so unpopular in the Senate, is actually the most popular aspect of healthcare reform among the public. In fact, as this process has been moving forward, American people have been losing faith in healthcare reform, but their support for the public plan has actually remained steady. So I like to say that as the bill became more and more conservative, Americans supported it less and less. That's very important to point out, especially in the media climate that covers this story as a he said, she said, as what will Joe Lieberman do, what won't he do. I think to highlight the public's position, which has always been for giving Americans a choice between public and private coverage, is very significant, and it's not a choice they're going to have in this reform.
It's also disturbing, I think, to many people in the public because the majority seems not to rule. It's a little confusing. During Republican administrations, it never seems that you need 60 votes in the Senate to do anything, but during Democratic administrations, you can't do anything without 60 votes.
Well, you're right to say that a lot of the signature bills under Bush, primarily the tax cuts, were shepherded through using reconciliation. When the Democrats took over, they made the decision, and the president made the decision, that they're going to go through regular order. Now, part of this, of course, they're hoping that some Republicans would join. When you're doing very large reform, it always kind of makes sense and makes better policy, I think, to try to do it in a bipartisan way. But as it turned out, Republicans weren't interested in jumping on board. But also, of course, there was the concern that if you do health care through reconciliation, you really have to do two separate bills. One bill that is able to withstand the very tough reconciliation process, because only provisions that directly affect the budget can go through reconciliation according to the Senate rules. So things like insurance regulations wouldn't be able to be in the bill. And so it kind of created this other layer of complication that if you do it through reconciliation, you'll have what Max Baucus liked to say, Swiss cheese reform. So they tried to avoid that. Should they have gone through reconciliation, pushed the public option through? I think that's a debate for another day, but certainly they tried to go a different route, a more conciliatory route, and unfortunately they were really not even met halfway by Republicans.
Obama, when he was a candidate, expressed support for a single-payer option, and I found it odd that he himself took that option off the table, even as a potential bargaining chip, before the process even started. Very much supported the public option, but really treated that as a bargaining chip very early on. And now we have a bill which, although, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that it is health care reform, is basically a gigantic giveaway to insurance companies.
Well, there is an argument to be made that if he had kept the public option on the table, we would see a more progressive reform. You know, it's that old Malcolm X, Martin Luther King dynamic, that Malcolm X was the foiled Martin Luther King, which is why we have civil rights reform in this country, because people thought, my goodness, if I don't deal with Martin Luther King, I'll have to deal with Malcolm X and black nationalism, and they certainly didn't want to do that. So there is that dynamic and that school of thought that if only he would have kept single payer on the table, we would have something with a public option. But as far as his own views during the campaign, my understanding has always been that he has said that if he was to start the system from scratch, unwind everything, go back to day one, he would have preferred a single-payer system. But given the fact that we have the majority of Americans in private coverage and employer-sponsored plans, that starting from scratch was just simply impractical. And I think many progressives agreed with that, not just from a political point of view, but also from a care continuity policy perspective as well. You know, it's difficult, I think, in general, to make the conclusion and the leap that this healthcare reform or this Senate bill is a giveaway to insurers. It's true that insurers will have some 20 million new customers, and I say 20 because about 10 to 15 million are going to go into Medicaid. So they're going to have some 20 million new customers, but at the same time, they're going to have to clean up their act. They're not going to be able to deny coverage because of pre-existing conditions. They're not going to be able to rescind coverage. So they're really going to be operating in this new environment of managed competition. They've never done that before. And I think that's very, very significant. So if you look at some of the analysis that's been conducted about how the various healthcare proposals would affect the health insurance industry, it's not that they lose money, because they certainly don't, but it's that they stay about the same, but more importantly, that you really do have a situation where millions and millions of Americans benefit from reform. So I don't think it's either one or the other, that it's either the insurance industry that benefits or the American people. I think you can strike a balance where you extend coverage to 20, 30 million people, where you regulate insurer behavior, and at the same time, you don't you don't bankrupt the insurer industry.
We're talking to Igor Volsky, healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress and co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Now, Howard Dean himself has, at least the last I read, not been very happy about this Senate bill.
Well, Governor Dean and I have argued on this point. This past Sunday, he walked back a bit from earlier comments he made that we should, the Democrats should kill the bill in the Senate and start over either in 2 years after the midterms or just take the process back to reconciliation. I disagree with that. I think that this provides a foundation for reform that we can build upon. It again extends coverage to 30 million Americans. It does all these new insurance reforms, and I think that's significant. You know, while I share, obviously, his loss, his grief over the loss of a public plan. We, you know, wrote a whole book saying how important it was. I think it is possible to get at some of the goals of a public plan through regulatory means, and I hope that Congress does this. But to throw this away and to say, let's start over, I think is fairly impractical.
What kind of regulations, besides taking away their ability to not give you coverage because of pre-existing conditions and not rescind coverage and so on, what kind of regulation is the healthcare industry looking at? Are they still going to make us pay all sorts of co-pays and out-of-pocket expenses, or is that going to be better for the customer as well?
Well, there are some out-of-pocket protections in the Senate bill. They're not as good as they should be, but they're there, particularly for the lower-income Americans. But what you're also doing, you know, the pre-existing conditions, the rescissions, no annual or lifetime limits, all very significant reforms. But I can't overstress this point enough that just the very act of putting insurers into a new marketplace called the exchanges in every state, where they have to follow these new rules and literally compete against each other directly, head to head, not on the healthiest applicants, cherry picking the healthiest applicants, but on the quality of care, because now they'll be offering, they'll all be selling a standard benefits package that will be defined. And that's what they'll be competing on delivering care efficiently, not on picking the most healthiest beneficiaries. So I think that's significant, and it's very important that these exchanges are well regulated, that the insurance commissioner in each state keeps his or her eye on the ball to make sure that they're not finding new ways to game the system. That's going to be critical, and I'm not happy that the people who are in charge of overseeing this entire new apparatus are the state insurance commissioners, because historically they've not done a very good job, and I would like to see some new kind of oversight mechanism to make sure that everything that they're supposed to be doing, that they're actually doing. That's going to be key. That's going to be a very big battle, and I hope they improve that, if not in conference, because that seems unlikely, then down the road. But, you know, the public option was significant, but the public option was only a small part of achieving competition, lower costs, and better quality care. And if we can now play with the cards that were dealt and get at some of those goals, I think we can, and I think we have to, really.
One of the terrible problems with the system as it exists now is that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people staying in jobs that they do not want to be in, purely for the health insurance coverage. Will healthcare reform affect people's ability to move in and out of jobs and still keep health insurance?
Yeah, job lock, as you point out, is a problem. It costs this country a lot of money in terms of lost productivity. What will now happen is if you choose to leave your job or if you lose your job, you'll be able to enter your state-based exchange, this new marketplace for insurance, kind of like an orbit for insurance. And you'll be able to choose among a menu of plans. So no longer will you be in a situation where you're 54 years old, you lose your job, you lose your health insurance coverage, and you have nothing, because nobody will cover your diabetes in the individual market. Now, when you enter in an exchange, they won't be able to deny you coverage for that condition. They'll have to take in, they'll have to charge you a community rate, an affordable rate, and of course you may also, depending on your income, qualify for affordability credits. So that's what I'm saying, is that this bill isn't perfect, but for a lot of people, it's going to make a big difference.
When do its provisions actually kick in?
Some of the provisions, things like you can't deny coverage to children based on pre-existing conditions, no rescissions, no annual limits, high-risk pools, catastrophic coverage, as it's called, for Americans who can't find coverage in the individual market. That kicks in about 60 or 90 days after reform is signed. The exchanges, however, start in 2014.
And you just said no denying coverage to children based on pre-existing conditions. What about adults?
That kicks in 2014 once the exchanges are operational.
So for the next 4 years, the insurance companies can still deny you, me, or anybody else coverage based on the fact that we had gallstones 10 years ago.
They could, but if they do during that interim period, it's possible that they won't be able to participate in the exchanges, because one of the changes that they made in what Saturday was revealed, the manager's amendment to the Senate bill, was they allowed the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the exchange commissioner to look and evaluate their record of denying coverage, of spiking rates, for instance, in the past. And if they are, you know, above a certain threshold or are egregious, then they won't be able to offer what's called a quality benefit health care plan within the exchanges. And that's a market that they want, a piece of. And I think that would be a serious problem for companies that go overboard in denying coverage. I mean, it's not a perfect kind of consumer protection, but I think it's an important interim stopgap.
There certainly have been issues in this whole healthcare debate about controlling healthcare costs. Part of it has to do with drug companies and pharmaceuticals, and there were questions of reimportation of drugs from other countries to get them at a lower price. Where does all that stand in the Senate bill as it exists now?
Well, there's no reimportation. Those two amendments were defeated. The administration promises to fight for importation another day, not as part of this reform. I think the administration made a decision, something they learned from President Clinton's failed effort, and that is if you can get some of the stakeholders, like pharmaceutical industries, insurance companies, if you can bring them to the table, and if you can negotiate with them and compromise with them, then you'll, in the long run, go a lot further in reforming the healthcare system than if you cast them aside and don't work with them. And I think in some respects, they're right. I mean, this administration in its first year has gone further than anyone else in history in this country in reforming the healthcare system. And the decision to forgo importation, which is something that the president supported when he was in the Senate, his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, supported when he was in Congress, was a strategic decision, which said, we're going to make an agreement with the pharmaceutical industry. They're not going to attack reform. We're going to pass it. And, 10, 20 years down the road or whenever, we'll try to do something about drug prices. Was that a fair bargain to make, a fair deal? I think people have to judge that for themselves, but it's clear that they made a decision that it's better to have a better shot at passing reform, at least with these interests at the table, than to get everything you want in one bill and alienate them and possibly risk the possibility of achieving healthcare reform.
Well, that brings up another question, which is, I mean, I think a lot of people, and not just liberals and progressives, but a lot of people, just average Americans, see this as a kind of, we've been held ransom by the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, and Joe Lieberman, and a bill gets passed, and the bill is incredibly imperfect from a lot of people's point of view, and has sold out, and has compromised its essence away in certain respects. How likely is it that there will be further health care reform 2 years from now, 20 years from now, ever?
Well, people raise very similar concerns about Medicare, that it didn't have enough services, it didn't provide very comprehensive benefits. And we saw over the years legislatures, lawmakers address that. And now, of course, you have hospice care in Medicare. You have drug coverage in Medicare, things you didn't have when the law was first passed in 1965. And so I think a lot of reforms in this country because of the way our politics is and the way our government is structured. You have a foundation, and then you build on that foundation over the years, and I think the same will happen with healthcare reform.
Igor Volsky is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. What happens now? The bill, if it passes the Senate, and that does look like the likelihood, right?
I think so. I think they will pass it on December 24th, Christmas Eve, at around 7 p.m., I think, is when they have it scheduled.
So if and when that passes, it has to then be reconciled with a House bill that is very different. What happens then?
Yes, the House bill is quite different. It has better affordability credits, better protections for out-of-pocket caps for lower-income Americans. It has a real employer mandate that requires large employers to offer coverage. It's a better bill. I think many progressives would want to see the House bill become law. But again, given the 60-vote rule in the Senate, that just won't be the case. And so what they'll have to do is go into conference. And I think, unfortunately, the House, which has worked very, very hard on reform, is going to have to adopt most, if not all, of the provisions in the Senate bill and pass reform. Because, again, anything that screams of a public option or Medicare buy-in or something that removes the excise tax on high-cost plans that's in the Senate bill but not in the House bill will simply be rejected in the Senate, and then we're back to square one. So I think there's going to be a lot of things the House is going to have to swallow. But again, I think if the choice is you either accept a lot of the provisions in the Senate bill or you have no reform at all, I think lawmakers will choose the former.
The 60-vote rule, so if there is a reconciliation committee and they come up with something that is more like the House bill, why do you need, I thought you just needed a majority to pass, I mean, if a bill goes back to the Senate floor, why can't they pass it with 51 votes?
You need 60 votes to cut off debate on the conference report and move it to a final vote. For the final vote, you only need a majority.
Right. So that's where it would be held up. Are there, I was reading somewhere that there are movements to amend some of those rules so that so the Senate can't really be held hostage by a couple of spoilers anymore. Do you know the status of all that?
Well, there's some talk about it. Senators Harkin and Lieberman had proposed back in the 90s amending the 60. You know, it's important to point out that the 60 rule isn't some kind of constitutional requirement. It's self-imposed by the Senate, and so they can change it whenever they like. And in the 90s, there was this push to change the way cloture is reached, how many votes you need. It was kind of an incremental scale that first, if you can't get 60, you can get 57, 56, and down from there. I haven't seen any serious discussions about bringing that kind of legislation, that kind of rule change up to a vote. We'll see what happens. I fear, though, it's kind of a passing fad. But when you're in the minority, I think you covet that 60-vote rule, that you can try to stop the opposition. And Democrats have certainly made use of it in the past. But it's, I think, important to point out that nobody, no party, has obstructed progress, not just on health care reform, but in every single piece of legislation that the Senate has seen, like the Republicans in a minority now. It has just been extraordinary. A couple of decades ago, the minority party would filibuster only about 8% of the legislation that came through the Senate. Now, with the Republicans, it's in an all-time high of 70% of all legislation they filibustered. And it not only does it slow down kind of our lawmaking process, but it's the reason why they're there, voting at 1 a.m., voting on Christmas Eve, because Republicans have really slowed everything down.
Igor Volsky, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. I am reachable at Radio Cafe. I am reachable at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. The podcast site is santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.